This is Elodie Reed, digital producer for Vermont Public Radio. This podcast has been edited for brevity and clarity.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. He talked to himself in public. He drove a 20-year-old car that he affectionately called the Loser Cruiser. And at least once, he was mistaken for a vagrant and offered a free meal in exchange for sweeping the floor. Those were some of the indignities endured, or more accurately, deeply enjoyed, by Vermont author Howard Frank Mosier. Mosier was beloved by many in Vermont and beyond, and appeared on this show many times over the years to share insights about life, writing, and living in the Northeast Kingdom. He died in early 2017, and today we want to take some time to celebrate and remember him. We'll hear him in his own voice, and we'll share excerpts from a show in 2017, recorded the day after he died, as friends and readers shared memories and appreciation. First, a conversation with Howard Frank Mosier from 2012. He had just published his memoir, The Great Northern Express, A Writer's Journey Home, about an extensive book tour that he organized himself. Here he is reading an excerpt from the book.
I will read you the section in which I call ahead to arrange my bookstore appointments. This is called Herald Who Calls Ahead.
Very Seussian.
Yes, very Seussian. Hi there. This is the novelist, Howard Frank Mosier. Silence. I soldiered on. May I please speak with your bookstore events coordinator? Yeah, well, that would be me, I guess. Terrific. I'll be publishing my 10th book this summer, and I'm putting together, if you can believe such a thing, a 100-city book tour. Let's see. I'll be in New Mexico in the second week of July. I was hoping we could arrange. Who'd you say this was? Howard Mosier, the novelist? Good grief. Could I be losing momentum already? Harold who? Howard Frank Mosier? So, are you a local author, or what? Well, actually, I'm from Vermont, but Vermont, the events coordinator, who might have been all of 15, could hardly have sounded more outraged if I'd announced I was from Guantanamo. Hey, Harold, I'm with a customer, okay? Email me. Howard. Say what? It's Howard, not Harold. Mercifully for us both, the line went dead. Scores of phone calls later, by virtue of sheer bullheaded stubbornness, I had somehow managed to set up about 150 book events in 100 or so towns and cities nationwide. In introducing my new novel to the overflowing audiences that I would no doubt attract, I had decided to start by talking about my life and work in the place I have long called Kingdom County. I might even show some slides. That was it. For my old-fashioned Great American Book Tour, I would put together an old-fashioned slideshow. I'd call it, Where in the World is Kingdom County? Go for it, Phyllis said. There are worse things to promote than novels. Like what? She thought for a moment. Amway products? It's come to this, then, Reg, this is my imaginary uncle, Reg said to me a week later as we headed up the sidewalk toward my friend Linda Ramsdell's renowned Galaxy bookshop in Hardwick, Vermont, for the launch party of my new book. Lighten up, I replied, to the consternation of the polite elderly gentleman who had offered to carry my slide projector into the store. The milestone that authors work for years to read was at hand, publication date. And for me and my ever-present uncle, the eve of an adventure we'd been waiting half a century for.
Howard Frank Mosier reading from The Great Northern Express, his new memoir, and it is all about that adventure. Reg, your imaginary uncle, plays a large role in the adventure. Of course, a story can start anywhere, and you've given us a little flavor of where your story starts. And I guess technically, it starts in the backseat of your dad's car listening to your dad and Uncle Reg argue about Red Sox and Yankees games. But this tale kind of starts in earnest with you musing over whether or not you could ever get a MacArthur Fellowship, which of course comes along with a great purse and allows a writer who gets one to explore, see the world, write something new, live with money and feel comfortable for a little while. That was not the cream-colored slip that you got in the mail one day when you walked to the post office. Can you tell us about that and how that sort of begins this tale?
You're right. It definitely was not the cream-colored slip that I got, but I am a born romantic, as my readers know, as you know. And I always think when I walk to the post office in the morning, oh boy, today's going to be the day that MacArthur grant's going to be there, that or that check for $1 million. I don't know from who, but that check is going to be there. And so far from a large sum of money that would enable me to spend the rest of my life fishing in Labrador, I got a notification from my physician that the PSA count from my latest prostate blood work was elevated. So that's, of course, something you don't want to fool around with. About 30,000 men a year die of prostate cancer in the United States. So I immediately signed up for 44 very intensive radiation treatments. This was 5 years ago. They seem to have done the trick. The last treatment happened to coincide with my 65th birthday, and I thought I should celebrate. So I had been warned by my entire oncology team, whatever you do for the next month or two after the treatments, you need to rest. Don't coffee up. Don't drive yourself harder. Rest. And so I took that advice to heart and set out the very next day on my 150-store book tour in my 1987 Loser Cruiser with 280,000 miles on the odometer.
So you listen well. That's one thing we should know about you. You listen well to what the oncologists tell you.
Well, you know what they say. You can ask a Vermonter to do almost anything, but you can never tell a Vermonter what to do.
You took, though, to calling not just this adventure, but your cancer and then what you were going to do with this life now, assuming that you were going to be able to continue living it. You started calling that your own personal MacArthur grant, and you followed the stipulations that come along with that money, if only you could have received it. And, you know, it sort of launched you into this book tour. But as you read in that little piece from the book, it didn't really get off to a very glorious start.
No, it got off to a very bad start. I had, I had thought that I wanted to take a trip in commemoration with a trip that my real Uncle Reg, not my deceased Uncle Reg, imaginary companion, and I had long wanted to take, but also to give myself some time to reflect about my life and work in the kingdom. And on the very first day of the trip, I had my only difficulty with the Loser Cruiser, the whole 20,000 miles, it just broke down on I-95 a few miles north of Boston. I had about half an hour to get to my next book event, and I did the only thing I could think of. I left the Loser Cruiser beside the road and got out and began to hitchhike. Well, I will pick up anybody when I'm driving. It's a great source of material. No one was going to pick me up. Finally, a guy in a commercial bread truck stopped. And in the flurry of getting into the truck and trying to explain to him what on earth I was doing, I gave him the misimpression that I was going to be hitchhiking all the way to California and back. And he was so indignant. He said, "You mean at your age, your company won't rent you a car to make this?" And actually, that part was true enough. But he was such a good guy. He took me right to my event. And what could have been a very embarrassing launch of the trip turned out fine. The next day, on my way back from the McDonald's next to the Comfort Inn in White River Junction, I stepped right in between a mother moose and a calf moose before I knew what I had done. And that's the one place you don't want to be when it comes to moose. So the only thing I could think to do was to offer my cup of Newman's Own and my bacon, egg, and cheese biscuit to the mother moose And I said, "Here, Moose." And the mother moose, who by then was pawing the ground and snorting, was not impressed. Well, in the meantime, some Chinese tourists who were just boarding a bus over at the Comfort Inn evidently thought this was part of their day's entertainment because they began to videotape the confrontation between me and the mother moose. Well, I made a mad dash for life back to the motel and got out around the angry moose, and the tourist continued to videotape this performance. So when I got inside the motel, the desk clerk said, "You shouldn't fool with them animals." And I said, "I wasn't fooling with those animals. I was trying to get away from them." And one of the gentlemen who was continuing to videotape this encounter took up my part and said, "He no fool with, he run from big deer, small deer." So in commemoration of that event, Jane, I wrote my first and only haiku, which I will now repeat for you. Big deer, small deer, chase clueless author, born under sign of jackass.
It's one of many headlines that you actually write on this tour, though, of how you could be killed ingloriously on the book tour and written about regional author killed in, you know, by moose. I love that because, you know, it is such a sense of humility and humiliation in some cases on this tour, but also such fun that you have with everything that happens to you and all of the characters that you see. But listeners, I might invite you to search YouTube, see if you can find Howard Frank Mosher trying to get away from the big deer and small deer. I'm sure it's somewhere on the web. Susan wrote in to say, "Thank you for every single book, Howard Frank Mosher. You're a gem." And Jim from the Great Falls on the Otter Creek writes, "Thank you, Howard Mosher, for giving voice to these hills and her often eccentric elements. You've made my sap sweeter, my brook trout quicker, my bees fiercer, my canoe lighter, and my deer, well, my deer just as scarce as they've always been." You've got a lot of fans out there.
Well, those are much better reviews than the first one I received on Amazon.com for Walking to Gatlinburg, my last book. The reviewer wrote in and said, "If you're looking for a good Civil War novel, ... maybe you'd better keep on looking." And that was the good part of the review, and then it went downhill from there, although nothing will ever quite compare to the headline of a very major review in a paper whose name will never cross my lips again. When I wrote my first book, Disappearances, it said, "Vermont writer should disappear."
Did it really?
It really did. And I was young then, and I made up my mind that whatever else happened, I wasn't going to disappear. So it was a baptism by fire into the literary world, but it probably worked for me.
Well, actually, several people wrote into us about Disappearances. Certainly your fans don't want you to disappear. Maria says, "Your interpretation of life and death in Disappearances is fantastically mind-blowing to me. I kept your book close and read passages from it while my father was passing away, and it was such a comfort to me because of how I interpreted death as the body quietly slipping away into a well, or just into thin air as in the movie, instead of something final, something taken away from me, instead of worrying about the pain of death. Incredible how it changed my thoughts of death. Thank you. I want to know how you thought of the disappearance idea of dying."
Well, it came bubbling up out of the clueless author's diseased imagination. But of course, on my Great American Book Tour, I did think about human mortality. And I did think about, as I said in the Great Northern Express, what I loved enough to live for. And I came to some conclusions about that. None of them were really transformative or revelatory, but they affirmed some things I'd long suspected. One was that, although I had many doubts at the time, it was the right thing to do to go to the Northeast Kingdom to put down stakes and to write about it. Another is, I asked myself, what really means something to you in life? And I kept coming back to the same things, family, friends, the place where I live, reading and writing. Very simple. So the trip gave me time to think about those things, and the radiation treatment gave me time, period. What good would the $500,000 MacArthur grant do if I had a month to spend it in?
You write a lot about the first year that you spent in the Northeast Kingdom in this book. The book traces your path through the United States, but also traces that first year and your thoughts and your wife Phyllis's thoughts as you thought you were doing this temporary stint as teachers in the Northeast Kingdom before you could move on to bigger and better things, and how you evolved in thinking, wait a minute, there are stories here that I have to tell. When you first arrived, though, what did you think you were going to do after that first year?
Well, I was young and I was naive, and I thought that someplace out there there was a blueprint that would show me how to write stories that somebody other than maybe Phyllis and my mother would want to read. Well, I've learned over the long years that there isn't any blueprint. I suppose reading the classics is the blueprint, and you pick up by osmosis what you need to know. But what I discovered when I got to the kingdom is that it was a veritable gold mine of stories that nobody else had ever written. I think Robert Frost had written one poem set in the Northeast Kingdom. Other than that, hardly anybody had written a word about it. And soon after we arrived, our landlady told us a story, and this was a transformative experience. She said that during the Depression, she and her husband owned a hill farm near the Canadian border, and they were losing it. They just couldn't make a go of it, and so she decided to put to use the only skill her father had ever taught her, and that was how to make moonshine whiskey. Well, one night as she was running off the White Lightning by the local brook, she looked up, and by lantern light, she said that she saw across the stream what she described as a pair of city shoes with a man wearing a city suit standing in them. And she knew immediately he was a revenuer. She said, "You can arrest me if you want to, but I want you to know that if you do, we're going to lose our farm." When she looked up again, he was gone. Well, years went by, decades went by, and she and her husband kept the farm, put their kids through high school and the University of Vermont. Then her husband died, and she moved into the village of Orleans. And a few years before Phyllis and I came to town, there was a knock on her door. She answered the door, and she recognized the man standing there in the city shoes and the city suit. And she smiled and said, "Have you come to arrest me again?" And he said to her, "No, ma'am, this time I've come to marry you." And he did. And they were very happy together, as she had been with her first husband. And then he died. So when she finished her story, she looked at us and she said, "You know, Howard and Phyllis, I've had a good life, nothing to complain about, but I reckon I just ain't had good luck keeping my husbands alive." And at that point, almost 50 years ago now, Phyllis and I looked at each other, and we knew that I just didn't want to write the stories of the kingdom, but that one way or another, I was going to write the stories of the kingdom.
I wanted to mention, because Mark wrote in and said, you know, your book, Northern Borders, gave him this greater appreciation for the Vermont that he came to know. And as we've talked about, you arrived in the Northeast Kingdom in 1965. And Greg, who actually now lives in Salt Lake City and listens online, tweeted, "I hope you'll consider asking Howard Frank Mosier on his thoughts on what it means to be a Vermonter."
Oh, that's very easy. It means to be independent-minded and individualistic, almost to the point of being self-defeating. Not quite.
That was Vermont author Howard Frank Mosier on what it means to be a Vermonter, from a conversation we had together in 2012. Today, we're listening back to interviews with Vermont author Howard Frank Mosier. Mosher died in 2017, leaving behind 13 books and a legacy of generosity, humor, and wisdom. Let's go back to an interview with Mosher from 2010. We were talking about the subject and plot of his books. Several of his novels, like Walking to Gatlinburg and A Stranger in the Kingdom, incorporated real historical events. But Mosher said the characters and the stories came first, not historical accuracy.
I always like to point out that I'm a storyteller. I'm not a historian in disguise or a political analyst in disguise. So instead of doing any research or reading at all, I went right home and I spent the first year of what turned out to be a 7-year project writing a rough draft of Walking to Gatlinburg. And that way, when I did come to do the reading and the research, I was able to fit it into the story and the characters rather than trying to tailor the story and the characters to the research. But I did not stay very close to historical facts, and you can bet that if I say that Abraham Lincoln was in one place doing something at a certain time, he probably wasn't.
Would you describe yourself as a Vermont writer or a writer who happens to live in Vermont?
Well, I think I'd describe myself as a resident of the Northeast Kingdom who happens to write. And because I lived there for almost 50 years, I write about the kingdom.
What responsibility do you have to the people who tell you these stories? I mean, you take the nugget of the story and then you do change it and it becomes fiction and it becomes a part of a larger story often. Do you feel a responsibility to the neighbors who give you these fragments of stories?
Well, that's an excellent question, and no one's ever asked me that before. I feel a responsibility not to say anything that would be cruel or hurtful about them, certainly to change their names. And but I feel no responsibility to stay particularly close to their stories. Often I'll begin my writing process by writing a story I've heard just exactly the way I heard it. But 50 drafts later is pretty different. Sometimes my neighbors wouldn't even recognize it. The most controversial book I've written is A Stranger in the Kingdom, and that was based on a very tragic racist incident that took place just up the street from where we live in Irisburg. I remember saying to my wife just before that book was published, all my neighbors are going to be angry with me about this book. And I remember Phyllis thinking for a moment and then saying, that's right, they will be. And I want to tell you two things. Number one, that's why you have to write this book. And number two, they'll get over it. And she was right on both accounts.
You write frequently, Howard, about Kingdom County, and I'm sure people ask you all the time where that is or what it's based on. Is it a real place or an amalgamation of other places?
It's definitely an amalgamation of a number of places. I would say it's most closely based on the Northeast Kingdom of Vermont, but it has some of the flavor of the Catskill Mountains, where I grew up in the 1940s and 50s, and even northern Maine and northern Quebec, and a very liberal dose of Howard Frank Mosier's diseased imagination. My neighbors are always asking me, where can we find this village of Kingdom Common that you're always writing about? So I say, well, Kingdom Common is an amalgamation, as you said. It's part Irisburg, where we live, part Orleans, part Newport, and again, a large dose of my imagination. And my neighbors understand this and nod, but they still may ask me, where can we go to see the village of Kingdom Common? And I guess the answer is in my books.
Well, speaking of your books, we got an email from Scott in Fayston who says, Disappearances is one of my favorite novels. I love the rich French-Canadian history interwoven into the tale, and Quebec Bill is one of my all-time favorite characters. Quebec Bill's physical characteristics and abilities are, of course, rather extraordinary, but is he based in any way on an actual person?
Yes, Quebec Bill is based very closely on Wild Bill Royer, a French-Canadian fiddler and storyteller par excellence, whom Phyllis and I met almost 50 years ago when we first came to the Northeast Kingdom. And I think that Wild Bill inspired the character of Quebec Bill, particularly in his tremendous optimism and great empathy for almost everybody.
For people who haven't read Disappearances, can you give us the plot summary?
The plot of Disappearances is absolutely insane, as is the writer, I think. But it's the story of a French-Canadian farming family in 1932 who are going under. They just can't make their bank payments, and they can't buy hay for their cows. The cows are starving to death. And so Quebec Bill, this indefatigably optimistic farmer, decides to make one more whiskey run into the wilds of Canada, bringing the whiskey back into the United States and selling it, and thereby hangs a tale. He takes his son, Bill, with him on a canoe trip into the Canadian wilderness, and really all I can say is all hell just breaks loose. There's a villain named Carcajou, the Wolverine, who turns out to have an important connection with Quebec Bill and Wild Bill, who chases them with mayhem in mind. There's a lot of magic realism in that novel. I was very influenced by Gabriel Garcia Marquez's 100 Years of Solitude when I wrote Disappearances. And it is a wild sleigh ride of a book. My friend Wallace Stegner called it a hymn to irresponsibility, and I guess probably it is. I'm glad I wrote it when I was 30, because now that I'm 68, I probably wouldn't write that book. what I look for is not realistic plotting, but psychological realism with my characters, and I kept my friend Bill Royer carefully in mind as I worked with the character of Quebec Bill. So I think the characters, with the possible exception of the madman Carcajou, are reasonably realistic. Certainly there was a lot of whiskey running going on along the Quebec-Vermont border during Prohibition, but the plot is highly unlikely, and I might say that's true of virtually every other book that I've written. When it comes to plot, I pull out all the stops and away I go.
When you write, there are some recurring themes. We hear a lot about loggers. We do hear a lot about whiskey running, struggling farmers. And you mentioned that when you moved to the Northeast Kingdom, you and your wife realized that there were stories here that weren't being told. I imagine that most of the people who were telling you stories about Prohibition and logging are gone now. So are you learning to tell new stories, or are you trying to keep that history alive?
Well, I've got so many stories that date back to the Prohibition era and the Depression that old-timers told me when my wife and I first came to the Northeast Kingdom that I think I would never run out. At the same time, periodically, I like to take a Northeast Kingdom character outside of the kingdom, as I did with Private True Teague Kinnison, a madman who attaches himself to the Lewis and Clark expedition in my novel, The True Account, and much more recently with Morgan Kinnison, the 17-year-old hero of Walking to Gatlinburg, who in that novel actually does walk from northern Vermont to Gatlinburg, Tennessee during the Civil War looking for his older brother who's missing in action.
You mentioned a name that comes up frequently, Kinnison, and we got another fan who posted on our website, "On Kingdom Mountain got me hooked, and now I'm checking your books out of the library three at a time until I finish them all. I'm noticing the same family names and same characters across your novels, and I imagine a wall in your house outlining the genealogy of Kingdom County with a bio for each individual. Am I close?"
Yeah, see, that writer is close. In fact, I came up with the very extended Kinnison family when I was writing A Stranger in the Kingdom. That was a tough book to write, and I worked on it for 4 or 5 years before I really got the handle to it. But one night, as I was struggling with the story, a sentence came to me, and I wrote, and I think I can quote it. When I was a boy growing up on the Kingdom Ghoul, my father and my older brother Charlie couldn't say two words to each other without getting into an argument. I didn't know where that sentence came from, but the more I looked at it, the more I realized that that had been written by a new character in my imagination, young Jimmy Kinnison, who at 13 years old narrates A Stranger in the Kingdom. Once I came up with Jimmy His family occurred to me. His father, Editor Kennison, the editor of the local paper, his older brother Charlie Kennison, the lawyer who defends the falsely accused minister in the story. And that was really the beginning of the Kennison family. They're based pretty closely on my own, although the story was inspired by an event that took place in Irisburg in the summer of 1968. But the Kennison family is pretty closely based on my family.
So you don't really need a wall tacked up, the whole genealogy tacked up in your house. It's all in your head.
I think I'll put a genealogy in my next novel just for the fun of it.
Oh, good. Now, we've got a lot of callers on the line who want to talk to you. I want to read a quick email to you first. Stacy in Coventry wrote on our website, "Your talented wife, Phyllis, was my science teacher at Coventry Village School. I know you've mentioned that she is your muse over the years, and I'd love to hear more about this and how your relationship has impacted your writing." And before we get an answer to Stacy, let's talk to Steve in St. Albans. Hi, Steve. Go ahead.
Good afternoon, Howard. How wonderful to find you on my lunch break. And it's just great to hear you. I really wanted to mention, in addition to being just an outstanding, wonderful writer, you've been such an inspiration and a mentor to both myself, but so many writers in Vermont. And I don't know if the general public knows that, but the amount of time and caring you put into helping other fledgling writers is really extraordinary. And I just think that's a wonderful thing. And the other thing I wanted to mention, and she just mentioned it from the other email person, is I've always been moved by your dedications of your books to Phyllis, and I know she has been part of the character, at least, in a number of things, and you've always mentioned that love stories are the best stories, and I am also curious about how your love story with Phyllis has and just continues to be part of your fiction writing.
Steve, thanks so much for the call. Howard.
Well, thank you, Steve. Steve is a wonderful writer in his own right and also a wonderful physician and friend. First of all, Phyllis, when I was working with Walking to Gatlinburg, and I'll use that as one of many examples, I needed a young, beautiful fugitive slave woman to fall in love with my main character, Morgan. And I like to begin with a character with a real person in mind, and then as I move along with the character, sometimes she or he will acquire flesh and blood, but I like to begin with a real person. And I could so clearly remember sitting in my senior English classroom in high school next to a very dear friend of mine who I thought, because of her sense of humor and great sense of compassion, not only for people but for all living things, would make a wonderful model for Slidell Collateral Dinwiddie, my runaway slave. And so I used that dear friend from high school, and that worked out pretty well. And it would be surprising if it hadn't, because I've now been married to that friend for 46 years. To go to your first question about helping other writers, that was very kind of you, Steve. You know, at a book event I did not too long ago, someone said to me, "Howard, I'm just an aspiring writer." And without knowing I was going to say this, for once in my life I told the truth. I said, yes, and every time I start a new book, so am I. So that's a situation I can identify with. Thanks, Steve.
You know, when you talk about other books, your eyes really light up. You can see it, that you love reading and talking about books. Are you almost more of a reader than a writer?
Well, I don't know if I'm more of a reader than a writer, but I'm going to make a confession to you that I don't very often make. I love to write, and only rarely do I have anything approaching writer's block. How could you live in the Northeast Kingdom in the middle of all of these stories and have writer's block? You couldn't. But as a writer, I can write in a bus station. I can write at my kitchen table with grandchildren around me. I can write any place, and I love to do it. But I think I live to read. And every afternoon about 4 o'clock, I start reading, and I read right through until 10 or 11 or midnight, maybe with an eye on the Red Sox with the television on mute. But I have always, since I was a small boy, loved stories and loved to read.
Speaking of the Red Sox, Alan in Bennington says, I read Waiting for Teddy Williams just before the Red Sox won the 2004 World Series. I loved the novel and fell in love with all the characters. I believe that reading that novel just before the playoffs began created the necessary karma for the Red Sox to overcome the hated Yankees and win the World Series. Thank you for your many great novels.
That's a very, very kind response. And after the Red Sox won the World Series, about a month after Waiting for Teddy Williams was published, I had a great and wasted opportunity. I got a call from a senior editor at Sports Illustrated who wanted to interview me, and he said, well, Mosher, you wrote the book, and in the book the Sox won the series, and then they won the series. Are you a prophet? Okay, there was my golden opportunity. I should have said, yes, absolutely, I'm an oracle. I knew that was going to happen. But for once in my life, I told the truth. And I said, you see, he caught me off guard. I said, no, I'm not a prophet. I'll tell you how the Red Sox won the World Series. They went out and hired Curt Schilling. That's pretty much how they did it. You remember Curt pitching with that bloody sock.
Absolutely, yeah.
And getting them to the series. So I think I got a two-line interview in Sports Illustrated.
It'll teach you not to tell the truth. We have time for just one more quick call. Rita's been waiting on the line with us from Keene, New York. Hi, Rita. Go ahead.
Hi. First of all, I want to thank Howard for many, 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 many years ago when he first came to Vermont, giving me rides back from Lamoille Union High School to Orleans. The other thing is, as I was in the car at the ripe age of 17, I used to think, this man is so arrogant to think that he can write about true Vermonters. And as an adult, I love his books. I find he has kept the guts and the reality of true Vermonters of the Northeast Kingdom, yet made them sometimes wild and fantastic, and other times very dramatic and sad. And I just want to say thank you.
Well, Rita, that's a wonderful tribute. And Howard, perhaps you can't get a better tribute than somebody who thinks you're a flatlander and an outsider at the beginning and now sees that you've really captured Vermont.
Well, that's very kind of Rita. I'll put it in a nutshell. The people I write about, like my neighbors, are independent, and they don't like authority, and I'm independent, and I don't like authority either. So we'll leave it at that.
Howard Frank Mosher, thank you so much for coming on the program today.
Thank you very much.
Today we are revisiting some of the conversations we had with Vermont author Howard Frank Mosher. Listening to past interviews and enjoying his tales, some real, some imaginary, and the inspirations for his novels and characters. On January 30th, 2017, the day after Mosher's death from cancer, we spent the Vermont Edition Hour letting Vermonters, friends, and fans share the joy, humor, and wisdom they gleaned from his novels and life. We were joined that day by two of Howard's close friends, novelist Jeffrey Lent and filmmaker Jay Craven, who adapted four of Mosher's novels into movies. Here's Jay Craven.
Well, I think that his generosity, more than anything else, which was articulated so many times to writers that he even never had met but would send him a manuscript and he would take the time to read it and offer a comment. Certainly his generosity to me, the faith that he placed in me, taking his stories and translating them into another medium, necessarily an economical medium where a lot of detail has to be left out, but rendering these larger-than-life characters who simultaneously were so flawed and even self-destructive but heroic and larger-than-life. It was just a pleasure. I got a note this morning from Craig Nova, writer, longtime Putney, Vermont writer who's now teaching in North Carolina, but talking about how there's a way that you can be with someone that is just like unlike anything else or anyone else. And when that person goes, you lose a part of yourself in that process. And I think that's sort of what it was for me with Howard, the nature of the conversations, the laughs, the sort of standing up to authority that was so telling in his characters that he sort of felt at a gut level himself. That, you know, the loss, I think we all feel a bit of loss with Howard because he was so much with us through his characters, but also through his generosity and also through his visits to every corner of the kingdom, every corner of Vermont, all over New England, and was always such a pleasure to share those moments with.
You mentioned his mentorship, and we got notes from a couple of writers who experienced that. Thomas Christopher Green, the president of the Vermont College of Fine Arts, says, "Howard was the most selfless writer I've ever met. He was also a bridge builder between literary people and literary communities. Howard got behind my first novel when I didn't yet have a publisher, and we didn't even know each other. I found his address in the phone book and mailed it to him. He did the same thing for Richard Russo, and we know how that turned out. Howard later introduced me to Richard, who got behind my fourth novel, The Headmaster's Wife, a complicated book that initially had trouble finding a publisher. It later became a bestseller in no small part because of Howard and Richard's support. He was the glue of this Vermont writing community, our dean, someone we all admired and looked up to, especially how he modeled to all of us that writing was not a competitive sport, a friend to all. Last year, when he was nominated for the Vermont Book Award, he told me he didn't want to win and he didn't want to be a finalist. That should go to a younger writer, he said, not an old guy like me. At the ceremony, when Major Jackson won the award, I saw Howard on his feet with a big smile on his face. The room was full of people in black tie and nice dresses. Howard had on his flannel, his jeans, and work boots. He will never be forgotten by any of us who he mentored." And Shay Totten says, "As a young writer in the NEK about to leave for college to study writing, I sent some of my poems to Howard to see if he had any advice to a budding writer-poet. It was early 1986. Within a month, he replied, and I still have that letter, which was encouraging in tone, generous in advice, and thoughtful. It was clear to me that he had actually read what I had sent him, as he cited back lines and images to me. He could have easily dismissed my outreach or sent me a simple best of luck to you note, but he didn't. This handwritten letter is 2 pages long, written on lined yellow legal pad paper. In it, he provided a lengthy but supportive critique of my work. This letter gave me such a confidence boost, as he wanted to be sure that I would continue my path to study poetry, literature, and work every day at being a writer, be it in college or on my own later. His biggest advice was to revise and revise again, noting that it sometimes took him years to write his best stories, and he said some would be rewritten 50 or 60 times. That knowledge, that even strong writers like Mosier had to revise that much, humanized writing in a way that hadn't been done for me before." And another author, fellow writer calling in now, Howard Norman. Howard, thank you for calling. I know you were friends with Howard Frank Mosier as well.
Oh, very much. Hello, Jeffrey. Hello, Jay. But I just wanted to say one quick thing, and I think that I was just in Italy and told a bunch of literary folks over there that I was from Vermont, and right away, and I mentioned this to you, Jane, earlier, right away, one of the professors there said, "Howard Frank Mosier." That was a very lovely moment. The term regionalist, of course, is reductionist, but that was a moment of international presence that I think happens far more often than Howard would have even recognized or acknowledged. A really, really beautiful, beautiful man with a very big heart.
Well, Howard Norman, thank you for sharing your thoughts and memories, and so many people sharing their thoughts with us today, people who knew him personally and who knew him through his work. Sarah says, "I've been fortunate, since my family moved to Irisburg nearly 3 years ago, to live across the road from Howard Mosier and to admire him not only as an author but as a beloved neighbor. Seeing him outside pruning apple trees or inside working at his writing table always gave me a sense of comfort that is hard to describe. My children enjoyed visiting Howard and his wonderful wife, Phyllis, as much as I did, probably because of the palpable love and warmth in their house." Patrick says, "I met Howard for the first time as a freshman in high school, shortly after reading and subsequently watching A Stranger in the Kingdom. I never made the connection, though, as the Mr. Mosier I knew was a kindly gentleman who volunteered his time assisting us high school basketball players in our shooting form. It wasn't until I was a junior that it dawned on me that the man I knew from hours of shooting hoops was the same man I knew through his books. He was an amazing person, and I thoroughly enjoy his works. But most of all, I appreciate his kindness and understanding as a genuinely great human being. And Cora says, I knew Mr. Mosher because I went to high school with his kids, and I would see him around. He was always very kind to me, always said hello when he would see me in Irisburg. He would always ask how my brother was and where he was stationed at the time. He was very impressed that my brother had made captain and was doing so well in the Army. I'll always remember his sweet, shy smile and the kindness he always showed. Kate and Leon shared a memory of when Howard spoke to the League of Vermont Writers in 2006. They say Howard gave a colorful description of first moving to the Northeast Kingdom. He also mentioned his way to deal with unfavorable reviews. Take them out to the barn, tack them to the outside wall, and blast them with a shotgun. Not recommended if you live in town. Howard's slide presentation that day included a picture of his barn wall. Greg in Salt Lake City says, when I get homesick, I pull out Northern Borders, and I'm soon back in the hardscrabble Northeast Kingdom, accompanied by such rich characters that only Howard Frank Mosher could conjure. And Sue says, I grew up in the Kingdom, but live in Brandon now. I always looked forward to Howard's visits to our bookstore and made sure I got there early so we could talk about the Kingdom and I could guess the inspirations for some of his characters. Occasionally, they were family members. We both loved the Kingdom, and I envied that he was still there and I wasn't. We both agreed there was no place like it. Don says, beautiful soul that brought the Kingdom's beauty to the world. It's been a pleasure meeting him and knowing such a great man lived in my neighborhood in Irisburg. He brought such joy to the world. Jeffrey Lent, you told me that you've started thinking about Howard Frank Mosher's place in a line of writers and how he sort of fits into a larger picture of writing about New England. Would you like to talk about that?
Yeah, I would. I really have just been thinking about this. And one of the things that we often don't really discuss, we talk about Howard's sense of humor and his sense of place and his intensely vivid characters. A lot of those characters are actually very dark and are very dark and twisted and troubled. And Howard is one of the great humorists also of the last 50 years and is rightly celebrated for the humor that he brings. It's a little complicated for me because I've read all of his work and I've also spent so much time talking with him, and his humor in person was much more dark than he often allowed it to show on the page. So I started to see that humor more darkly. He loved talking about different ways to effectively poach his beloved trout, for example. dynamite being the, you know, favorite weapon of choice. You know, so he had that sense of humor, and he let it out as recently as just this fall. We had a email conversation about why he wondered if it was psychopathic of him to find humor in such dark subjects. And I told him I thought it was really holding on to the delight and sense of humor that a child has, where they haven't yet learned appropriate responses to situations, meaning adult responses, mm-hmm. where they would laugh if they saw, you know, the classic person slip on a banana peel, for example. Adults try to hold that humor in, and the child would laugh. So I don't know. We talked back and forth about that, about the place of humor and darkness, and how close tragedy and comedy, of course, are so deeply intertwined and so closely connected to each other.
Expressions of gratitude for Vermont author Howard Frank Mosher. That was an excerpt from a show on January 30th, 2017, the day after Mosher's death. We've spent the last hour looking back at the life and work of this beloved author.